there's 25 golf courses that that Rayner built that are no longer there that were fully operational. And you know, these weren't just, you know, on a drawing board. These were courses that people played. And whether it was the Great Depression or World War II, or you know, like I say, growth of the surrounding area and municipal planning or whatever it was, but we've lost 25 of them. And so that's yeah, that's a shame. So yeah, each and every one of them, I would have liked to play.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks for joining us. Thrilled to have Michael Wolff on the podcast today. You know Michael, of course, from golf Twitter as Bama Bearcat and as the host of No Laying Up's Office Hours. Few people know more about golf books than Michael. And he joins us today to talk about his own, The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner from Back Nine Press. It's all you want to know about C.B. McDonald and Seth Rayner and their courses, full of things you won't know. Great if you know a lot about golf course architecture, or if you know nothing at all. It is a handsomely photographed book by John Cavalier, better known on Twitter as Lynx Gems. And Michael gives us a great education in this conversation about why Rayner matters and what is so unique about his many huge name contributions to the golf course landscape. It's a great listen if you are an architecture enthusiast or maybe would like to be one. So as the weather turns, it's sort of becoming golf course architecture season as folks spend more time on the message boards debating merits of various courses. It's also the time we start planning our holiday gifting and stocking up on provisions for the new golf season. And it goes without saying, the Titleist golf balls make the perfect gift. What golfer would not be thrilled to unwrap a fresh dozen Titleist Pro V1s or Pro V1Xs or the Pro V1 Left Dash or AVX golf balls? You know that feeling of that new dozen. I mean, you even have a good smell to them. These aren't just any golf balls, of course. Golfers know they're the very best, the most trusted golf ball in the world that deliver the performance we all need to shoot our lowest scores. They're the number one ball in golf for a reason. So make your holidays a little happier this year and learn more about gifting all things Titleist at Titleist.com. Of course, another great gift, the Golfer's Journal. No better last-minute gift than a subscription to the Golfer's Journal. Very easy at golfersjournal.com to give subscriptions to all your friends. And what makes it such a great gift is that four times a year, whoever you gift it to, someone's going to get a, it's literally, as our friend says, the gift that keeps on giving. You'll get pinged many times a year. Hey, this Golfer's Journal showed up again. It's awesome. I know I've given it away to a lot of people, and that's the experience I've had. So have that experience. And if you've already done that, another great gift. So many gifts on this podcast today. But don't forget about a very exciting new release from the Golfer's Journal, and that is the Big Green Book. The Big Green Book is in. It's shipping. It's happening. There's been a lot of buzz around this special project we undertook this year at the Golfer's Journal, and we could not be more excited to share it with you. 150 plus pages, a very large format. It is literally, it's quite big. The Golfer's Journal itself is large. This is even bigger. There are zero ads in it. It is 100% reader supported. It has a world-class roster of photographers and writers bringing fresh perspectives on the game. It is handsome. It's huge. It's beautifully constructed. It's a must-have conversation piece that will look great on your table or your shelf. We really got creative in this one with new writing and big images, and there's even a little poetry from none other than Billy Collins. So it's one of those things you sort of can't stop flipping through it when you pick it up. So order it today at golfersjournal.com. There are a limited number. This was a limited printing, so it is an exclusive collectible. So don't delay. Get yours today. Now let's turn things over to Michael Wolff and hear how an engineer from Long Island became one of the most important designers in golf, and how a golf book collector, in turn, became a golf book author. The Golf Courses of Seth Rayner. Let me get some friends to help me lift this up for the camera, Michael. Look at this beautiful book.
Yeah.
This wonderful... It is. It's handsome. Congratulations, man.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been a labor of love, but I've enjoyed it. Yeah, it's been fun. It's kind of been new to me, first time. And John Cavalier's photography definitely carrying the the bulk of the rave reviews, I think. And I just tried not to let him down with my writing. So that's kind of how this thing's gone. But it's been fun. We tried to get to every Seth Rainer course still around, and John, I think, made it to all but three of them to photograph them. And it's been about 3 years in the works, so it's been a learning process. But we're happy with the outcome, and we're certainly happy that everybody's been enjoying it so far.
Okay. As you should be. And that is no small feat, getting to all these golf courses. I definitely want to talk about, and it's interesting now, John has to come out from behind Lynx Gems, sort of
a little bit. Little bit.
Now folks know, might put a name to a handle. Same for yourself, Bama Bearcat. I want to get into the process of writing this and collecting all this. It's comprehensive. It's very readable. It's thorough. For any golf head or architecture geek, it's really wonderful. But I want to start with, for maybe someone who's not an architecture geek, there are people, believe it or not, out there who might not know who Seth Rainer is, who might not know Charles Blair McDonald and Seth Rainer. So tell us a little bit about who they are, their connection, and why they are so important.
Sure. So, let's start with Stephen McDonald. So Stephen McDonald is, I think he would like to still be thought of as the godfather or the grandfather of golf in America. And he probably earns that title. He was born in Canada, actually, but he grew up in Chicago. He went over to St. Andrews for school. His grandfather was a professor at the University of St. Andrews. And he literally got his first set of golf clubs and golf lessons from old Tom Morris. So as far as American golf and the link back to, the birthplace of the game, C.B. McDonald, Charles Blair McDonald, was that guy. And whether it was the formation of the, the USGA or Chicago Golf Club, which was the first 18-hole golf course in the United States, Stephen McDonald's one of those guys who just kind of had his, fingers in everything. He was certainly a very outspoken person. He wasn't afraid to let his thoughts be known on how things should go. And, in a lot of ways, his efforts were to bring what he thought were the most important parts of the game that he learned in St. Andrews, pace of play and the idea of, how the rules would work and that it's not supposed to be a game that's fair for everyone. It's kind of the rub of the green and things like that. And he also had that idea with golf courses. I think as golf became more popular in the United States, obviously Harry Vardon and Francis Willmette and all that happened in 1913. But even before that, as the growth was happening kind of right at the turn of the century, McDonald always had this dream of building, his ideal golf course. It started kind of as a, like a lot of us do, sitting around, a grill room or whatever and talking about what are the best golf holes. And he kind of ignited a discussion about that in a magazine over in the UK. And he just kind of grew it from there. And by the time he got to, just after the turn of the century, he was in a position financially and in his career and life that he wanted to try it. So he made several trips over to Scotland, England, France, and kind of studied the best holes and wanted to really bring that back to America and create kind of what he thought was going to be a blueprint, hopefully, for American golf courses going forward. And I think in a lot of ways he was successful. And then just by luck and chance, the guy that he helped, that he hired to build his first course was a guy working in Southampton as an engineer named Seth Rainer. Rainer had never played golf, didn't know a lot about golf at the time, but was a very talented guy. And, the book is mostly about Seth Rainer's work, but it's also kind of about this yin and yang between C.B. McDonald, who was this outspoken guy who could rub people the wrong way, but who traced his, his background in golf all the way back to old Tom Morris and St. Andrews. And he's paired with this guy who was polite and hardworking and earnest, but knew nothing about golf. And so I think that that pairing was interesting. And then, the other thing that that the book, covers a lot is obviously their recreation of the ideal golf holes. And again, this wasn't like, some cheesy golf course you'd see in Myrtle Beach or something where they're trying to build like an exact replica of the 12th hole at Augusta National or the 18th hole at Pebble Beach or something like that. McDonald really wanted to study why these holes were good and what what made him like him and other people like him, and then bring that back and incorporate it into his designs. And so it wasn't just that they were going to build the exact same holes over and over, but that they were going to use these certain features of the holes they liked. And, you know, you can call them template holes or ideal holes or template features, whatever. We kind of cover that in the book as well. But the overarching theme is it worked, right? The courses are, you know, a lot of them are getting ready to turn 100 years old, and people enjoy playing them, and they're fun to play. And there's definitely been a huge renaissance in the last 30 years, I would say, of, you know, not just golf course architecture in America, but also specifically with Seton McDonald and now Seth Rayner. And we're hoping, you know, that this book will help continue that and continue to promote that, because I like his courses, and I think most people will too.
I think most people do. And I certainly think it should do that. And yeah. And certainly there was a book that seemed to do that for Charles Blair McDonald when, and it's referenced in your, I think in the introduction here, The Evangelist of Golf by George Botto. So there's sort of the seminal like book on McDonald. Yeah. But there was no Rayner book. And so was that the impetus for this? Did you feel like, okay, we need a Rayner story? George Botto is a fascinating story to me as well. I don't know. I know John knew him.
John Dry Kennedy, Cleaner in New Jersey. So, yeah. I mean, as you can see behind me, I like books. I think most people that follow me online know that's kind of my where I come from. And this is certainly not from a writing angle or from a, you know, reporting and things like that. I just like to read books. And this has kind of been the one that's been missing on the shelf. Seth Rayner, most golf course architects from the golden age, meaning, you know, back in the early 1900s up until the Great Depression and the outbreak of World War II, most of them wrote books about their thoughts on golf course architecture, on how to plan a course strategy wise, and then also how to actually build the things, get them out of the ground. And they often did it because they had pretty big egos. But the other reason they did it was they used it as like sales and marketing tools. Rayner, you know, didn't do it. I think probably for a couple reasons. Number one, he wasn't a golfer and he didn't have any real firm beliefs of his own. You know, as far as we know, it was mostly, because he wasn't a golfer, he was kind of going off of what McDonald had taught him. And Charles Blair McDonald had written, you know, a book about golf courses or a couple chapters in his book, Scotland's Gift. But also, I think because Seth Rayner didn't need any more work. He was, you know, Charles Blair McDonald was this wealthy guy who built his ideal course up in Long Island, which is the National Golf Links of America. And then he built four or five or six other courses for close friends of his. Most of them had ties to National Golf Links, one way or the other. But pretty soon he said, hey, I'm not like, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get into this full time, but I've got this guy working for me who's very talented, named Mr. Seth Rayner, and I'll send him, you know, to New Orleans or to Cincinnati or wherever to build you a golf course. And I think he'll be happy with his work. And so Rayner really had a pretty full pipeline, which is a pretty envious position for, you know, any golf course architect, to getting into the business. He was a guy who was really busy from the day he started, you know, in the profession. And so the idea of like trying to advertise his services or, advocate for his specific ideas on how to build a course, which is something he didn't need. So he never wrote a book. So there was never an original book from Rayner. And then as it applies to kind of the modern library and the reporting on things like that, I mean, Tom Doak wrote a great book about, and some friends of his wrote a great book about McKenzie, Alistair McKenzie, and Jeff Shackelford wrote what I think is just a fantastic biography about George C. Thomas and his work, and Brad Klein with Donald Ross, and you know, you kind of go on and on. But Rayner was the one that was always missing. And as you say, there was this dry cleaner in New Jersey who was fascinated with stuff long before any of us, before the internet, before any of that stuff. And Mr. Botto, I never got to meet him, but he wrote, you know, a book about Seton McDonald that really, I think it helped to jumpstart interest in this and really just, if nothing else, helping to kind of catalog what he had found out about what courses were still left that those he had been involved in. There were always, you know, he had intended to make it a three-part series where it was going to be, the first book was going to be about McDonald, the second book was going to be about Seth Rayner, and then the third book was going to be about Charles Banks, who was kind of a protege of Seth Rayner. There were some notes that he did, and those have kind of been passed around within the community. Rand Morissette from Golf Magazine and Tom Doak, I think, you know, his was a friend of George's and saw some of those notes and things like that. But you know, it kind of started and stopped over the last 25 years and nothing happened. And finally, I think we just kind of got tired of waiting. And when John told me, yeah, I've only got like 5 Rainer courses left to go see. And we started figuring out, well, how many are there? And trying to document some of the stuff. And we thought, well, let's try it. If we want to read it, even if nobody else wants the book, at least, you know, we'll at least have it for ourselves. And that's really, that kind of has been the approach, is like, well, what would we want to read about this? And for me, it's, you know, the book is much less about, Charles Blair McDonald as a person or Seth Rainer. We try to tell you enough to like give you your background on how they approach this, but it's really about their work, the golf courses that are left. I mean, it's not a deep dive biography where we're telling you, you know, the names of the ships that he sailed on to, you know, when he went here or there, a lot of dates for this or that. It's mostly about the golf courses that he built. And I think that that's probably, the best way to remember him is what he left behind. And I've enjoyed the renaissance that these things have had over the last 30 years, people, you know, restoring them and rebuilding them and the appreciation for them. And I'm definitely in that wave of people that have kind of just sought them out over the last 2 decades and wanted to learn more and more and more about
them. There's so many people, especially, you know, rediscovering Rainer and all the Golden Age architects. And but that's really what makes it such a fun read, as you go through and you're looking for the courses you've played or courses you want to play, that you do deep dives on all the Rainer courses out there. There are more than I thought there were, far more than CB McDonald is credited with. Let's just throw out some names. So people who are listening who might not know, do I know a Rainer course? Have I played one? What are some of the big names that, I guess we could go through the table of contents, but it's quite long. What are some of the courses people are definitely going to know?
Yeah. So, let's see, McDonald and Rainer, McDonald designed 7 courses that Rainer built. And then on his own, Rainer built 34 courses that are still around today. And then there were another 25 courses that he built that are no longer around today. Either the course is completely gone or it's been redesigned. So there are still about 40, 41, 42 courses that you can still play. And then there's another, you know, like I say, there's another 25 in the book that we cover that were built and they're gone. And we've tried to dig up old photos and things of those. And then to me, the most tantalizing section is there's a whole chapter four of the book, which is in the back, which is the designs that he made that were never built, either because, you know, he had passed away or because, the Great Depression hit and people, you know, were running out of money or whatever it was. And, I find those fascinating as well. He designed a lot of second courses. There was supposed to be a second course at Yeoman's Hall. There was supposed to be a second course at Yale. There was supposed to be a second course at mid-ocean and Fisher's Island. And you think like, wow, what would a second course at Fisher's Island, you know, how cool would that have been on the other side of the island? You know, so things like that were interesting to dig into. So it's, you know, the names, I mean, like I say, it's big names, it's big name clubs. McDonald was an extremely wealthy guy. I mean, he was hanging around, you know, he was Wall Street and he was hanging around with JP Morgan and, you know, names like that. And so, a lot of the courses that Seth Rainer inherited were for wealthy people and they were all for private clubs. And, I think a promising thing and something that I certainly think is a very positive development in the world of golf is that these things were behind, you know, I think I wrote they're behind lock gates and manicured hedges, you know, for about 3/4 of a century. And really something that's really helped, I think, with the renaissance of appreciation for Seth Rainer is that people can, it's easier to see his work now. I think because of the developments in technology, with drone photography and just digital image taking in general, you know, somebody like John Cavalier, you don't have to get up on a ladder behind every tee and take 3 photos and then get back to your studio and develop the film and hope a couple of them turned out okay. John can take, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 photographs in a half of a day and pick the ones that he thinks best show off the course. And I think that even at the most private of courses, you know, whether it's Chicago Golf Club or National Golf Links America or, you know, wherever, I think once the membership and once the people that make the decisions about those places, once they saw that, okay, this is, you know, these new guys with these flying helicopters that they're calling drones, once they understood that, like, oh, these guys are here because they love the architecture and they're showing our club and our golf course in the best light, they're a little bit more willing to do it. And John Cavalier was he was an early adopter of that. And I think he, you know, because of that, he just kind of got his name out there and the Lynx Gym name out there. And, you know, a lot of clubs that, you know, you wouldn't have been able to, you know, get a camera into 20 years ago are now willing to. And I think that's true also with, you know, it's like the stuff that, you know, Golfers Journal does. I mean, the kind of the societies that have developed. I love that. I think it's a positive development where, you know, you guys are taking a group of 50 golfers on a Monday when the course is closed. And I think that's a win-win. You know, the club involved gets some revenue and there's 50 or 60 or 80 people to get to go play one of these private courses that, you know, they would have had no access to 20 or 25 years ago. And now some pretty great golf courses are letting people on, you know, at least a couple times a year. And, I think that's a great model, you know, that, it still preserves the, you know, the privacy of the club and the membership, but at the same, but it also, you know, lets people that really love it and are interested in it, you know, get inside and get a chance to play them. So yeah,
that's absolutely. I agree. It is great. We had a great group at Sleepy Hollow this year, CB McDonald. Well, looking at the book though, there were some, I learned some books, some courses that I thought were McDonald or Rainer. I might have had them backwards, but that's why it's great to read. But we were able to get folks out to Sleepy. We have some more McDonald and Rainer courses on our 2024 offering that we'll be dropping very soon. Very excited about that. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah.
And when folks are at those courses, they have, as you mentioned, the chance to play these things. People hear about template holes, ideal holes, etc. Mm-hmm. It's become a bit of a buzzword among GCA folks. I don't know in a good out of good or bad, but tell me what we're talking about when we say temp, because I think one of the great things the book does is that you pull out examples from some of the courses and explain, okay, this is a Cape hole, this is an Eden, things like that. Explain what the templates are and maybe describe some of them for us.
Sure. So neither Seth Rainer or Steve McDonald ever used the word template. That's just a modern word that's been used. some of the diehards hate that word because it implies that it's just like they found a formula. Now they're just doing it over and over and over again. I wrote a little essay, poking a little bit of fun at that argument on page 10 of my book. There's just a little essay called "Our Template Holes Ideal," just kind of telling everybody, hey, let's take a deep breath on that one. Like, this is not that serious of a topic. Let's have some fun here. But the ideal holes or templates or whatever you want to call them, it's really more about features. So again, Steve McDonald, he went over to UK. He saw, you know, whether it was a hole at Brancaster or a hole at the, you know, the old course in St. Andrews or whatever. And they didn't try to replicate, you know, every inch of that hole from tee to green and, you know, and all the slopes and everything like that. It was basically just kind of the design style. So whether it's a, on an Alps hole, the idea of, you know, hitting over a large, you know, object, whether it's a, you know, side of a mountain or it's a sand dune or wherever it is, depending on, you know, where the course is, to a blind green or a punchable green. That's, you know, it looks like a punchable. I mean, it's low. The lowest spot is in the middle of the green and all, everything kind of funnels towards the middle. And, they use different features like that in different combinations. So you can go to one Seth Rainer course and there's an Alps hole design that has a punchable green, like at National Golf Links America. And then you can go to another Seth Rainer course where he uses a punchable green, but he uses it on par three, not on a par four. There's Redans. A Redan is a hole borrowed from North Berwick where the ball is meant to kind of run along the ground once it lands. And they typically would go from short right to back left, on a par three. And so you're kind of playing a little draw into it. And hopefully it takes kind of the kicker, they call it, or the slope of the green and can funnel to a back left 10. People get to see that on TV once a year out at one of Seth Rainer course on TV every year, out at Wailea. 17th hole that they have there. It's the eighth hole for the members, but 17 on TV. And you can see, you know, the pros trying to do it. They're kind of fun to do because it's pretty easy to understand the strategy. The addictive thing about it, or the fascinating thing, I think, is how they apply those ideal designs to different places. And so, you know, it's still the basic kind of risk reward strategies and pretty easy to understand what's going on or what you know, if there's two routes to the hole, which one is, you know, what the risk is and what the benefit is, you know, is pretty easy to understand after one player or two. But to me, the fascinating part and the thing I hope people enjoy about the book and the photography is how well really Seth Rayner, a genius that he was, in applying those to so many different settings. I mean, you have Metairie down in the outskirts of New Orleans. Metairie it's the flattest golf course I've ever seen. I mean, there can't be 5 feet of elevation change over the entire golf course. You know, but it's the same hole designs as Fisher's Island, which is, you know, on this just spectacular, you know, small island right off of the coast of Connecticut versus, you know, Chicago Golf Club, which is essentially out in a prairie. You know, it's out in a field, on the outskirts of Chicago. And, you know, some things that you'll see in the book from the photographs look very familiar from one place to another. You'll recognize, you know, as you page through, and I kind of like the ones that I hadn't played, when I, you know, I see some of John's photographs and I realize, oh yeah, that looks exactly like this hole from, you know, from Chicago Golf, or this, you know, this looks like from the creek or from Piping Rock or whatever. But it's different agronomy and it's different, you know, some of these things are right next to the water where there's constantly wind. Some of them are in, you know, the middle, you know, Mountain Lake, which is in the middle of Florida, you know, and just how they apply the different agronomy, you know, whether it's bank grass or Bermuda grass or whatever. And it's interesting to me the talent that they had for applying those, you know, basically like, you know, 20, 22, 24 different, you know, ideal designs or template features, whatever you want to call them, how they use them in different combinations at different golf courses and made them apply so well, you know, no matter where they were and what the agronomy was and kind of what the demand was. I found that pretty fascinating. Pretty talented guy, I think.
No doubt, and deserving of a book like this. And yeah. It was interesting to read things I thought about some of the ideal holes, you know, like that a cape hole is not just about the drive, because you see that kind of. So when we're talking about a cape hole, you think, oh, it's one of those bite off as much as you want kind of, you know, driving holes. But that it's really more about the features in the green, which was interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you see a lot of, you know, Florida courses, good and bad, where there's this, you know, you're kind of driving diagonally from the tee over a body of water to a fairway that's kind of sloped diagonally away from you, and you got to decide how much you want to bite off. Well, you know, Rayner and McDonald, they did design some holes like that, but that really was not the main point. The main point of a cape is that the entrance to the green is only, you know, there's only like a quarter of the green that's accessible, easily accessible, and the rest of it's surrounded by, you know, either water or sand or a built up mound. And again, I like the differences on that. You know, there's a, you know, whether you're at some place that, you know, you see one in the book that you've never heard of before, or there's a famous one like Chicago Golf or whatever. It's interesting how they achieve the same basic, strategic principle. In some places they could work with what they had to make a great cape hole, like the most famous one probably, which is the fifth hole at Mid-Ocean, which has been photographed and painted and, you know, seen, you know, widespread over the last 75 years or whatever. But then you go to these, you know, small little places in New Jersey or New York and you've never heard of it, but you get there and, oh yeah, there it is. Like, that's the same thing, only they've built up a 5-foot mound because they didn't have an ocean or a lake or, you know, a sand trap nearby. And it was, or they just had some leftover dirt from another hole. And so they just built up, you know, essentially a mound around 3/4 of the hole. And I think that's, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting to see. And I think the John's photography, cool. I think, does a really good job of showing that off. And like I say, I've tried to put into words some of that myself.
So what was the process in doing this? I mean, I'm really interested in, I've never done a book like this. So how does it come about? I mean, it's this, there's a lot of photography, a lot of, you know, great photography, a lot of writing. There are three names on the cover. So how did you divide up the work? How did you get to all these places? How did you write about, how did you collect? I mean, you say John was able to get to all or most of them. Yeah. Did you need to get to all of them as well? What was the process like?
Well, it was a good excuse to get to as many of them as I could. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I know, and that deal.
Yeah. Explained to my wife that this was absolutely necessary for work purposes. I think it was just a lot of them started off kind of almost as like book reports where I had a copy of their club history or something. And really my library at my home, the course history books are what I like to collect the most, books about golf architecture or club history books. And I have found, there was definitely kind of a trend over the last 10 years or whatever, that the books that people would ask to borrow from me or like call me and say, hey, could you look something up for me? It was a lot of Seth Rayner courses that I found I was pulling from the shelves and, you know, checking on something for somebody. And so it kind of started there. And then, you know, for the courses we knew about and kind of just trying to identify, okay, what makes this, you know, what makes this course unique from all the other Seth Rayner courses and what do we really want to focus on? You know, is it something like, Stephen McDonald when he designed, you know, St. Louis Country Club? They had a polo field in the back. And so that made the routing a little bit tough because of where the polo field sat. And, you know, how did they deal with that issue? And the answer was it's one of the rare McDonald or Rayner courses that have five par threes. Usually there were the four standard par threes of Biarritz and Eden or Redan, in a short hole. And, for that one, they put in a fifth hole. Because the land behind the polo field essentially was only, they couldn't get, you know, par four, or par five back there. So they put back to back par threes that are kind of mm-hmm. underneath or south, I guess, of the polo field. So just kind of, you know, things like that. I did start out like trying to build this huge spreadsheet and kind of document where they put each template on each course and see like, you know, were there trends on, you know, did they use certain templates more than others? Was there, you know, were there interesting examples like at Greenbrier where, you know, they finish with a short hole, a short par three, meaning, you know, a short, for those that don't know, it's a par three and it's almost like an island where the green is typically surrounded completely by either a bunker or water or, you know, something. And, the Greenbrier is the only one that ends, you know, with an 18 hole that's a par three and it's a short hole. We didn't find a whole lot of trends of like, they always made the first hole, you know, this or that. Really the only one we really would pick up is there's a par five, you know, template or design feature called a long, and, longs were typically used either on the ninth or 18th holes of a lot of courses. But other than that, you know, we found a lot of one-offs, that we found interesting. You know, why did they pick, you know, Metairie to build back-to-back par fives for the 17th and 18th holes? You know, it's the only Rayner course where it ends on a back-to-back par five. You know, just things like that that would kind of stick out. Mm-hmm. We try to give the reader a little bit of like the who, what, where, like who built the course, who hired Rayner in the first place, you know, how long was he there? You know, the records are terrible. Rayner didn't save any records. So, you know, trying to just, you know, we didn't try to be the final arbiter in each case of, you know, does Rayner deserve 80% of the credit for Gibson? You know, Gibson Island and Charles Blair McDonald deserves 20% or at Yale, was it 50-50? Was it 60-40? You know, that's lost to history and, you know, anybody who's ever built a golf course, even the golf courses today, you know, they call them a Tom Doak golf course or a Gilhance or whatever, but there's a whole army of people that are driving bulldozers and contributing ideas to those guys. And it's, you know, or Coren Crenshaw, you know, is, you know, is Kapalua, is it 60% Ben Crenshaw and 40% Bill Coore or vice versa? That's, you know, to us, that was not interesting for the book. The more interesting thing was, you know, why did it get built? What did they build? How does what they built compare to what is still there today? How much of it is basically still there today? And then just to kind of give you a sense, you know, is it a quiet, sleepy neighborhood club, you know, in upstate New York that's, you know, is mostly used by families and just for fun golf? Or is it someplace, you know, that's held, you know, the Walker Cup and U.S. amateurs and things like that. And is one of the real blue bloods of golf, or is it someplace like Metairie that was, you know, completely destroyed by a hurricane and had to be rebuilt by Brian Silva and talk about that process. So yeah, they've all got their own little story and we tried to give each one of them, enough pages to tell the story without making this thing a 900 page long book. So that was, that was kind of my process. I'd like to ask you some about your process because this is my first time trying to tackle anything like that. The one big mistake that I think I made that I'm kind of curious from you is when I was like starting the basics research on each course and each club and everything, I would take the notes like on paper. And then like when I tried to go back and type it, and I would do one course at a time, like it created so much double work. I should have just typed it like right into the computer. And, you know, as I found interesting things, I should have just like typed a sentence at a time and then figured out how to arrange the sentences afterwards. But I don't know. Yeah. Is that something you do? And I also like, I realized like I've started way too many times. Like I thought way too much like about the first sentence or two or three sentences I was going to write. And I always have a hard time like ending the chapters, like figuring out as a relatively newbie writer. I find it much easier to start than it is to wrap something up.
Well, no, I mean, beginnings and endings are everything, right?
Yeah.
Because readers can forget everything that happens in the middle can be an accident, or readers can skip it or forget it. But first lines and last lines for readers and for authors as well, that's where it's at. Yeah. So they occupy, I mean, yeah, for me personally, they occupy, you know, 80% of the time is openings and closings. So yeah, I'm there with you. It's interesting when you talk about take notes turning into pages. Because say like with the America book, I had 500 pages of notes, mostly dictated from the road. And I remember reading through it and, you know, but never really looking at it again. But it was the material was a little different as well. I would consult the notes when I needed facts and yardages and things like that. But that doesn't sort of, you know, in a memoir sort of narrative, that doesn't come up as much. So yeah. The notes were sort of there as a backup for me. And that's still what they are with the book I'm working on now. I always feel like if it's something that in your memory, doesn't come back to you clearly, or it's not something like ready to fall out of your mouth, like a story to tell, then it's not probably worth telling. But I mean, this, the goal of what you're doing here is collecting a lot of history and information as well. So, so it's a little bit of a different, trajectory. However you did it.
The hardest part is definitely trying to boil it down. And that's really, so the third man in this fight club is Jim Sitar, who Jim runs Back Nine Press.
Yeah. I want to make sure we meant
absolutely. Jim. And Jim's sure. Name on the book, because he was the one that was, you know, completely responsible for number one, this thing being done in time for Christmas this year and not in time for Christmas of 2029. And also, he was the one that was responsible for making sure that this thing didn't end up being about 800 pages long. So he had the difficult task of taking, you know, my research and my, you know, drafts that were, you know, always too long, he would constantly remind me like, well, we can do this, but if we do 10 pages on this club, then we got to cut 2 pages from this club, or, you know, and so it was really, he was the one that was really helpful in kind of sticking with the page budgets. We literally like had a page budget of, you know, trying to figure out like, okay, we know these, you know, 15 clubs are pretty big name clubs that people are interested in. Or maybe there just hasn't been a lot of stuff that people have seen of those clubs before. And then there's some other places that, you know, maybe they've only got 4 or 5 holes left that are still original Rainers, or you know, maybe it's a club that's been discussed widely and kind of, you know, think, you know, there's other information out there for people if they really want to go get it. And so maybe on those, we try to cut a little bit. The other thing that Jim, I think he did a great job with, that Jim edits and produces books, that I would have never thought of. And, you know, John has mentioned to me, John Cavalier has mentioned to me, it's different than what he normally does, you know, on social media or whatever is. I think Jim did a really good job with the book too, of like reminding us, you don't want to use the best photo from each course, you know, and you don't want like, because it kind of, people become numb to it. If like every photograph looks like it was taken on the 4th of July, like with a wonderful blue sky and white clouds, you know, dotting the background and everything kind of dark green. John takes gorgeous photographs and he makes any golf course look good, but Jim did a pretty good job of reminding us that like, hey, if somebody's going to sit down and go through, you know, 5 or 6 courses at a time, or if they're, you know, they're really into it and they're going to read 100 pages of this book, all in one sitting, they're going to kind of become numb to the photos and none of them are going to stand out if they all, no matter how great the photos are, if they all kind of look the same. And so, mm-hmm. Jim was the one that was really good at, you know, giving some readers a sense of like some of these courses that are in, you know, up in New England or in, you know, New Jersey or wherever, you know, what it's like to be there on a fall day when the leaves are already off the trees and, you know, the grass is starting to show a little yellow versus what it's like to be at Fisher's Island on a bluebird day, you know, in the middle of the summer when, when the wind's blowing 5 miles an hour and there's, you know, yachts bobbing out in the distance, and it is the ideal time to play it. And I think he did a real good job of, you know, or what's it like springtime in you know, in Minnesota when, you know, things are just starting to pop. And so I think Jim did a good, really good job that, you know, I wouldn't have thought of. And, you know, I think I'm speaking for John Cavalier there. Jim did a good job of kind of helping to, you know, not just with the editorial process of My Chicken Scratch, but also, John's, you know, making him understand there needs to be kind of a, almost like a storyline with the photos themselves, you know, that they, it's not all the greatest hits. It's also, you know, showing some things from different angles and different, you know, views on things. And,
you cannot put a price on a good editor, or a photo, same for a photo editor as well. So kudos to Jim and Back Nine Press as well. They're doing really exciting stuff. Like this book, The Golf Courses of Seth Rainer. I saw a recent Twitter post from you that listed some interesting stuff. Courses, the three courses that surprised you the most. The courses that weren't built and the courses you wish you had more time to research. So I want to ask you about those. And that was kind of the fun of reading this for me is, you know, to book courses I hadn't heard of or had no idea they were associated with Seth Rainer. So the surprise courses you list is Morris County, Rock Spring, and Knollwood. Mm-hmm. Tell us about those courses.
Yeah. So Morris County was founded by women and run by women. It was a ladies golf club, formed by a group of very interesting ladies that, you know, to get exercise and something to do in their community. It was incredibly important club in early American golf. I'd seen the name before, but I didn't know a whole lot about it. And I mean, they hosted, you know, U.S. amateurs and women's U.S. opens, you know, in the 1800s. So they had several kind of rudimentary golf courses and they had to move a couple of times. And that's a theme that's in the book with a lot of clubs is a lot of times Rainer didn't necessarily build these clubs' first golf course. They had a golf course that was like laid out by members or something. It was nine holes. And then they would acquire a plot of land and they would decide, okay, you know, we've been playing, you know, essentially just out in this field with some holes in the ground for the last 10 years. Now we've got an extra 50 acres or whatever. It's time to hire an expert to build our new course. And so Rainer was involved in a lot of those type projects. But yeah, so Morris County was definitely, you know, run by women, for women, played by women, and an interesting history where they were involved with USGA right from the early days and hosting big tournaments. So yeah, that's what caught my attention about Morris County.
Very cool. What about, where's Rock Spring?
Rock Spring is in Orange, I believe it's called Orange County. I'm not sure if that's a township or the city's name. It's a public Rainer. If you look at the photos in the book, or if Tom wants to put one up with this, they're absolutely spectacular. You know, some of the Rainer holes that are still there and just wonderful. Public course, municipal course. So it was a private club, went through some reorganizations and a merger that apparently didn't work out so well. And the town or the municipality of Rock Spring or Orange County, they own the club and they've been operating as a municipal. And I had no idea that there was a Seth Rainer course that you could get to, an hour, within an hour's drive of Manhattan, that anybody could play, as just a municipal course.
It's in New York? There.
Yeah.
New York, Orange County. It's in New Jersey. Oh, Orange County, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, folks. It's in
Northern New Jersey. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Had no idea. So that was a good one.
Neither did I. And my wife's from up there. Okay. Yeah. Put that on the list. Where's Knollwood?
So Knollwood is, that was one I didn't know anything about. I'd never heard of Knollwood. That was kind of that was one where, you know, as we were trying to compile them and figure out which ones of these are real, Rainers, which ones think they're Rainers, which ones, you know, it was among the last ones I worked on. And I'd never heard of Knollwood until we started working on this book. And then lo and behold, John drives up there and takes the photos. And I literally text him with him, you know, he's in the parking lot. And I say, you know, is there anything left? Like what's there? What's, you know, whatever. And, you know, no response, no response, no response from John. And then like 30 minutes later, he's like, holy shit, you should see this place. And so it was, you know, yeah, it was the photos in the book are just, you know, that's one of those that, you know, it's not all there and intact. It's not all original. And we kind of describe that, but you know, the, some of the holes that are there are just, yeah, they're just, you know, spectacular. There's an Eden, that's kind of an elevated raised version of an Eden par three. It's almost like a blend between an Eden and a short, in that it's completely surrounded. 75% of the green is surrounded by a bunker that's, it looks like something from Langford & Row. It looks like one of the deeper bunkers that, I've ever seen on a Langford or on a Rainer course. And one of the steepest slopes on this, I think it's the 16th green there, kind of sits back in the corner. And it's just a fascinating hole. Yeah, so that's Knollwood. It was, I'm looking right now. It's
Did
in
we
Elmsford.
Say what state that's in?
Yeah, Elmsford, New York. It's in New York. It's in Elmsford.
Another New York course. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he did a lot around there. I mean, it was a lot of,
yeah.
You know, he also built a lot of, the National had, you know, a lot of wealthy members. In fact, one of my favorite, like, little fringe Rainer things that's in the book, all the way in the very back of the book, is he built like five different golf courses for guys, like in their backyards. Guys that were wealthy enough to have their own golf course. Some of them were like three holes, you know, with different sets of tees, so you could play, you know, play them in different setups and stuff. But like, I mean, he'll build a course for a guy that was a member at Newport, and you know, there were nine holes right next to Newport that was in a guy's backyard, and he owned them and decided, and he had his own tournament there and invited, you know, some of the best players to come play in his annual tournament and things like that. So again, I just kind of stumbled, you know, across stuff along the way. And if I found it interesting, I figured the readers would find it interesting, and you know, I would make a note about it. And, you know, we tried to get as many of those in there as we could.
Any of those backyard courses? Knollwood. Are any of those still around, the backyard courses?
No. Well, yeah. There's one that's still in the original location, but there's not, I don't think there's much of Langford left. Otto Kahn, who was just a fabulously wealthy guy, he had one built for him. And then, what's that thing called? It's now called, I'm going to forget the name. They changed the name of it. It was essentially in the backyard of his mansion. The mansion is now like a convention center or something. It's out on Long Island. And and the golf course has been changed, so it's not what it was.
So you've mentioned it a couple times. Just tell me, an Eden. This is just personally for my own golf knowledge, because we know what a Redan, Biarritz, very obvious. A short, pretty obvious. Then people all talk about the Eden, and I go, which one was that?
Yeah. So the Eden is based off of the 11th hole at St. Andrews.
Eden
ironically,
River,
it's
right.
The one at St. Andrews on the old course is not called the Eden. It's called High Hole Inn. In the fundamental characteristic of an Eden is the green, which is sharp, steep, pitched sharply from back to front. And there were typically two or three bunkers. The one at St. Andrews, there's three bunkers, and most of the versions that Rainer or McDonald built would have at least the two bunkers on, you know, front left and front right. And then the one that was even a little bit farther left. One of the bunkers is famous, that's the bunker that Bobby Jones hit it into his first time, you know, as a young man playing at the old course, his first, you know, attempt, at, you know, to play in a tournament at the old course, and was playing badly and kind of frustrated by the whole differences between, you know, links golf and what he was used to back in Atlanta. And yeah, the bunker on the, on the Eden green, short of the Eden green, was where he couldn't get his ball out, tried it a couple times, and depending on which version of the story, either, you know, tore up his scorecard or picked up his ball and quit the hole or whatever it was. But that was on the Eden green. They're not, most of the ones that Rainer builds are not as steep as the original one at St. Andrews. Tom Doak was nice enough to, you know, give me his thoughts on Seth Rainer and some of the ones. He says the Eden greens are the ones that are the hardest for him to, when he's doing a redesign or he's doing a renovation at a, you know, Rainer golf course. He said they're the hardest ones for him to renovate, because he always wants to build them like he knows the original was at St. Andrews, but that's not his job when he's renovating a golf course. It's to build it like back to what Seth Rainer originally intended for it. And I would say, you know, the Edens are one where, you know, he probably put a little more interest in the, you know, the bunkering and the surroundings of the green as much as the slope. And he definitely didn't slope them as severely as the most of his Edens he built weren't nearly as sloped as severely as the original.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
Eden. Got it. Now I know. Yeah.
So,
awesome.
So the Eden is the most common. So there's an Eden on. There's like two that didn't have Eden greens or didn't originally have Eden greens. Okay. Every other he would always build an Eden, and he would always do a Redan. He would almost always also do a short and a Ritz. Here Ritz was the of the four, you know, template par threes. The only one that he didn't use like every time or almost every time was the Beer Ritz. Most famously at National Golf Links of America, when they built their first course together, they didn't have a Beer Ritz there, but they pretty quickly would put a version. So most of the Rainier courses have four par threes, and they're usually those four templates.
It's Beer Ritz,
how he applies it.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest one to spot because it's got usually has a huge dip in the middle of it. The one at Yale is you could almost hide in a very deep valley, which would have come from. So Biarritz, there was a course in France. Is it still there? Is that where it came from? And is it true? I heard like the original one, like the dip was it actually in front of the green or maybe not on the green? Maybe I'm wrong. There's just a lot
we don't know.
Stuff out there.
Yeah, and nobody knows. It no longer exists, and we don't know. You know, I think conventional thinking these days is that they probably took McDonald probably got the idea from a couple of different features that he saw while he was down there. There was a famous hole, and there's a famous painting of it called the Chasm Hole at Biarritz. And Biarritz, by the way, was kind of a resort location. It's still there. And there's like three or four different golf courses that were all around, you know, these resort hotels there. It was like it's the place where all the people, when they were getting out of Paris and going on vacation down to the coast, that's where they went. So the Chasm Hole is probably where they got the idea for this, you know, dramatic forced carry, like at Yale. It's a one shot hole, but it's kind of this, you know, it's one of those where there's really no alternatives. You just got to pull out, you know, what for them would have been a driver. And for most of us today is still a 3-wood or 4-iron or whatever. There's really no bailing out. That's part of it. The second part of it was, like you say, is the dip. And the thought is that's probably from a different hole. We don't know if that was at the same golf course. There's a hole that was kind of down on the beach below where the chasm is. And, you know, I've got a book, from, you know, 1906, and there's some grainy photos and stuff in it. And you can kind of see some ideas of what where they would have maybe gotten those ideas from, but it's definitely, I would say it's the feature or the template hole, whatever word you want to use, that's probably the most they really are the ones that kind of perfected it and ended up should get the credit for that. I would say that one's one where you can't really point to one specific hole or one specific course in Europe and say that's where they got the idea. The chasm is maybe a start to the concept, but the chasm hole was only there for a couple of years. They kept moving it farther and farther to make the shot easier. It wouldn't be as much of a force carry. So
Yeah, it's a cool, well, it's always fun when you get to one for sure. I've never seen the pin put down on the chasm anywhere, but I'm looking forward to that someday. Yeah. A great section in the book about the lost courses, the courses that were done and then have been, for any number of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think of today that there would be a Seth Rainer golf course that was plowed under or a C.B. McDonald golf course that was.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of them in the book. Which one to you, are the biggest tragedies among that sort of obituary page in the book?
Yeah. Tragedy is kind of a hard word for the golf course, but yeah, I definitely
golf tragedies.
The links. So the links is it's just a fascinating part of kind of the Stephen McDonald story, which is he has this club. The club is still in operation. It's still a very, very, very nice place to go have lunch in downtown New York City. And it was on the Upper East Side, and it was kind of designed as like a golf clubhouse only in downtown Manhattan on the Upper East Side. And then they weren't, I found out through my research, they weren't directly related. So you weren't, just because you were a member at the city, you know, clubhouse doesn't mean you were also a member of the golf course that was just called the Links. But there was a huge overlap, obviously. And the Links was kind of built with the idea that, It was on Long Island, but it was, you know, like 30 minutes from downtown Manhattan at the time. And the idea was it was a place where they could kind of run out and play, you know, because these guys were all sickos that, you know, with their golf. And it was a place where they could kind of play in the afternoon when they had to like work, you know, the next day. It was like a place they could play after work or hit balls or whatever, when they couldn't, you know, because it was a long way all the way out to get out to Southampton and get out to National Golf Links of America or Shinnecock or Maidstone or wherever, you know, these guys were playing their golf back then. And so the Links was one of several. Deepdale was another one where they built these clubs that were essentially just right on the outskirts of New York City. And the idea with these places, they were going to be like in-town clubs. And what hurt them obviously was the growth and the expansion of New York City and then the Long Island expressway. You know, whenever you're building an expressway or you need land for just, you know, municipal development, golf courses are always an attractive place for politicians and city planners to set their sights on, because it's a heck of a lot easier to destroy one golf course that belongs to some very wealthy people than it is to have to, you know, buy up, you know, 1,000 houses from people and, you know, negotiate with each family or whatever and eventually throw them out if they don't want to leave. It's a lot easier to just kind of use the golf courses to get 2 or 3 miles of routing over your new expressway at a time. So Long Island Expressway didn't do any favors for a couple of them. And there's several Seth Rainer courses like that. But I think the Links to me is so fascinating because it's just a lot of things with it. They had one greenskeeper and one pro the entire time. So both guys lasted for 50 years each, their careers at the Links Club. And you could only become a member if like you were a direct male descendant of an existing member. So like there was no mechanism to bring new members into the club, which obviously spelled its doom. I mean, there was no, you know, there was no way to like to grow the club or like, you know, to expand beyond just those original guys. So, you know, if a guy's a member and he has 3 daughters like that, well, then now that's another, you know, member down once he dies because there's nobody to replace him. Or if your son moves out to San Francisco or whatever and doesn't want to belong or he doesn't play golf and doesn't want to belong to this club. So it was like doomed from day one. And it seems like they kind of didn't mind. I mean, it lasted a long time. They didn't finally sell it and plowed under and build houses until the 1970s. So it's kind of crazy. Like you mentioned, like that there were Seth Rainer golf courses and CB McDonald golf courses still around in the 1970s that somebody decided to build houses on and decided that was a good idea. And, you know, that's one that's, you know, fortunately, some guys, Tom Doak being one of them, was allowed to play right before they closed, and he was able to take a set of photographs, essentially from every green to tee, to at least, you know, document what it was like. But yeah, there's 25 golf courses that Rainer built that are no longer there that were fully operational, and you know these weren't just, you know, on a drawing board. These were courses that people played, and whether it was the Great Depression or World War II or, you know, like I say, growth of the surrounding area and municipal planning or whatever it was, but we've lost 25 of them. And, so that's, yeah, that's a shame. So yeah, each and every one of them, I would have liked to play. So
for sure. It is a shame. It's fantastic that you do give them space in this book so that they will live on. Was this, you know, as a collector looking at your background and knowing your love of golf books and of golf club, as you said, specifically club histories. Folks, if you wonder who reads those books, you're talking to him right now. It's Michael Wolf collecting golf club histories. And so sitting down and saying, we're going to write the Seth Rainer. There isn't a definitive Seth Rainer book. We're going to do this. Was it intimidating? Did you feel pressure in it?
Yeah, it was fun. To be honest, it was fun. John's, you know, he's easy to work for and work with. And Jim, like I say, was kind of the adult in the room with trying to keep us focused on, you know, he would have to remind us. I'd find this cool stuff that I, you know, and we're lucky that there's a group of amateur, you know, Seth Rainer researchers and guys that have just poured their lives into this. Mm-hmm. And most of them were very helpful, you know, with, you know, questions that we had and, you know, some advice on, you know, where we could look. Or again, I'd love your thoughts on this, but a lot of it too was not just like finding stuff and writing it up, but also learning, like budgeting your time and your space in the book for like dead ends, you know, to when you would, you know, you kind of knew some, there was probably some more stuff in there, but realizing like, okay, like, you know, you can't write a book for 20 years. Like at some point you gotta, you know, you gotta call it quits and get, you know, get this thing to the publisher so they can be ready for, you know, for people to buy it for Christmas or whatever. And that was always, you know, that was tough for me. You know, yeah. And I'm glad I had some help with that of, you know, somebody every once in a while tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, like, that's enough about this course, or like, yes, that's interesting to you to, you know, I know you would like some more information about this, but you know, we're trying to kind of make this also appealing to as broad of a audience as we can. And if you get too deep in the weeds, you almost kind of do a disservice to the readers because they, you know, there's probably right. not as many people out there that are going to hang into it. And you're, you know, you're just kind of slowing them down from enjoying what they want to enjoy about it. So, you know, there was a blend there yeah. of the commercial appeal to it, but also the personal, you know, interest in some of the stuff.
No, those are great points. And you, I feel like you get to a point doing this where you start to realize when you're writing something for yourself, right. more so than for an audience. And yeah. I, you know, hope, you know, you become in tune with that yeah. as time goes on. But yeah, there's nothing. I mean, you know, budgeting your time and dealing with, okay, where am I going too far in this direction, in that direction? Obviously, like we said, an editor's huge in that regard. But it's also the reason that I'll confess something here, Michael. I've never gone back and read any of my books after they've been published. Because when you send them off and you say it's finished, right? Because there has to come that day. Oh. And but I think any writer would say that I would be happy to spend the next 10 years working on this. Not happy, maybe go insane, but where it, you know, nothing, it's never ever really going to feel finished. And there's no way I could go back through a book right now and not want to change something. So I try to avoid that pain.
Yeah. How long did it take before there wasn't a pit in your stomach between, so from the time I sent the manuscript in until the time when like the first book, like bound, like, oh, here's the book. Like those, whatever that was, 2 months in between. Like the pit in my stomach of like, oh God, what have I done? Is anybody going to buy this? Like what? Like, and then the pit. And then the second one, which is far worse, is like from when I've got the book and I've already seen like 5 typos in there, you know, nothing major, but like typos in there.
Right, right, right.
But then I know it's going out to people, both people I know and respect. And I hope, you know, will think that this was a worthy, you know, effort, but also just like the general public and like, oh my God, like, is somebody going to start a webpage that says, you know, fire Mike Wolf and, like just the whole, you know, like chill, you know, BearmanBearcatStinks.com. So that's like just, you know, and I talked to a couple different guys that have done pieces and whatever. And they said, you know, some of them are like, yeah, it is what it is. Like I did the best I could. And then some of them are like, oh, it never goes away. I worry about it every day. So.
No, it's a terrifying thing to put something out there into the world. Right. And, and especially when, like you said, first editions are called first editions for a reason. No matter how many times they go through the copy editor, there's always something in there that is going to just blow, you know, that you might be the only one who notices, but will absolutely break your heart. Sometimes you find them and sometimes someone else finds them.
Yeah. And like you said, kind of, you know, you got to know when to say when, and you just got to live with it with just the fact that like, so much more of the research material now is, you know, it's coming online and it's searchable in old newspapers and things like that. I mean, this book wouldn't have been as good if we had tried to do it 10 years ago. And I'm sure 10 years from now, there will be, you know, more information on several of these courses that would have been interesting to know or something that we thought was correct. That's, you know, that's been proven otherwise or, I'm still hopeful that there's some courses out there that I don't know about. You know, I'm still hopeful that somebody somewhere is going to say, you know, oh, I've got this old newspaper that, you know, Seth Rainer was at our club. You know, we don't know about it. And I don't think that's available right now, but, you know, maybe in 5 years or 10 years, something will turn up. And I think that was part of the interest for me as well. That so many of these courses are, you know, diving farther into their histories and want to know and researching, and people are still finding routing maps from Seth Rainer. You know, I mean, just in the last 10 years, 15 years, there's been a couple of them that have been found at clubs, you know, in the clubhouse or, you know, at the local surveyor's office or whatever. It makes me optimistic that, you know, maybe there will be a revised and expanded edition in 10 years. Who knows?
There you go. That would be fantastic. We can come on and talk about that as well. Michael, I can't thank you enough. One, for the book. It's a tremendous resource. It's fun. It's a fun book to read. You can tell you guys had fun with it doing it. Yeah. Before you go, I'll just ask you sort of where we started with Charles Blair McDonald. As you'd mentioned, a man of strong opinions and ideas about how the game should be played. What do you think he would think of golf in 2023?
I think he would be appalled at the pace of play, for sure. I think he was a pretty practical guy, and so I think the expense of it, I think he'd be pretty disappointed with some of the stuff in the United States. I think there's other things he would probably enjoy about it, or at least, an enlightened version of him with the amount of young people playing and females playing and all that stuff, would be, I hope he would be encouraging of that. I know Seth Rayner would have been, but the cost and the pace of play in the United States, we have to do better. I think we're trending in the right direction. And I remain optimistic. I mean, is Florida ever going to turn into Fife Scotland? Probably not, as far as, pace of play and cost and things like that. But we're making strides. Like I say, just the fact that a knucklehead like me, who grew up as a caddy, in Cincinnati, Ohio, has weaseled his way onto, 50 or 60 of these golf courses is a testament to things improving in golf. Because if it was 1950, that would not have happened, I don't think, or even 30 or 40 years ago. And I found that especially among the Rainers and the McDonald courses, that there's some real pride there and a willingness to share and, kind of open things up. And I think that, like I said, I think that trend is continuing more and more and more, that if you really, really want to see, a golf course, there are more ways to find your way on there. It might not be the cheapest, and it might not be, at the time of year you're hoping for, whatever. You got to be a little flexible on these things, but I am a little bit optimistic, at least, that when it comes to golden age golf, that the stakeholders or the caregivers of these places are more willing to show it off, more now than ever. I mean, you can, whether it's the stuff you guys do or some of the other folks out there in the media landscape, it's I think it's awesome. Some of the features that you guys are able to write and some of the events you're able to host at some of these courses. So I think he would enjoy that and be, optimistic about that. We just got to play faster. We got to play faster.
Along. Amen. Yeah. And that's the perfect note to leave on. We have to play faster. Yeah. Absolutely. Michael, I can't thank you enough for the time. Congratulations on the book. Everyone check it out. The golf courses of Seth Rayner, and always follow Bama Bearcat and Lynx Gems. Always interesting stuff coming. So thanks so much. We'll talk soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, we strongly encourage you to become a member of the Golfer's Journal, or if you already are, to share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without you. We also couldn't do it without the help of our partners, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, LinkSoul, Omega, Charles Schwab, and BMW. We'll see you next time on the Golfer's Journal podcast.